come as a witness, for it will live unforgotten in the mouths of their offspring. For I know what they are inclined to do even today, before I have brought them into the land that I swore to give." So Moses wrote this song the same day and taught it to the people of Israel. So even though we call it the Song of Moses, right? It's not Moses' song, is it? It's the song of Yahweh himself. It's God's song. It's the song of the Lord. And, you know, when what this serves is essentially, it serves essentially as Israel's national anthem, by the way. We look at our national anthem, right? The Star Spangled Banner. I always thought America the Beautiful might be more suitable, but it's the Star Spangled Banner. And when we sing our national anthem, we only sing the first verse, right? Because there's like, what, four, five, six verses, something like that? Imagine singing the whole national anthem all at once, like all five or six verses of the Star Spangled Banner. First of all, I don't even know any of the other verses, okay? And, you know, some people, when you look at them at sporting events and the TV's right on their face and the national anthem is playing, it seems like they have a hard time remembering the words to one verse. But Moses taught this song to the people of Israel, and they taught it to their children, and they taught it to their children, and they taught it to their children. And God said, this song will live unforgotten in the mouths of their offspring. So let's examine what the national anthem of Israel is. The first thing that God says is, "Give ear, O heavens, and speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth." And this echoes a lot of the other language in Deuteronomy. Remember, the book of Deuteronomy is about God reforging the covenant with Israel, and creation itself stands as a witness to that. And so God calls upon the creation that he has made to again stand as a witness to this song and to the covenant that it commemorates. He says, "May my teaching drop as the rain and my speech distill as the dew, and let gentle rain upon the tender, like gentle rain upon the tender grass and like showers upon the herb. For I will proclaim the name of the Lord and ascribe greatness to our God." What a magnificent statement, right? It starts off in the best way you could imagine. And there's this description of all the wonderful things that God does. And I imagine that when David writes the 19th Psalm and the 119th Psalm, he may very well be inspired by the opening words of this song that God gave to the children of Israel. Because in certain sections of Psalm 119 in particular, let's just say there are a lot of similarities. The first thing that the song declares is that God is awesome. The rock, his work is perfect, for all his ways are justice. He is a God of faithfulness and without iniquity, just and upright is he. So it sounds good, right? Sounds like we're getting off to a good start. The first thing we do is we praise God. But imagine if your national anthem was filled with words about how horrible you are. Can you guys imagine that? If the national anthem of the United States of America was about how Americans are such horrible people and we're all miserable and we're worthless and we can't do anything right? Because that's kind of not what it's about, right? As a matter of fact, first of all, it's about our flag. Other great patriotic songs like America the Beautiful are about the land and the people, right? And they're full of idealism and aspiration and hope. Hope that we can be better than we were. Hope that every generation can build on what their fathers have left behind and make our country a better place than it used to be. But Israel's national anthem says, "They have dealt corruptly with him. They are no longer his children because they are blemished. They are a crooked and twisted generation." Wow. What words, huh? Because the national anthem, right after it starts off praising God, it turns around and the first words after the praise of God is, "We're horrible and we do everything wrong." It continues in this vein. Do you thus repay the Lord, you foolish and senseless people? Is he not your Father who created you, who made you and established you? So remember the days of old. Consider the years of many ages and ask your Father. He will show you, your elders, and they will tell you. When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the people according to the number of the sons of God. But the Lord's portion is his people, and Jacob is his allotted heritage. And what this song is all about is how God gave them this unimaginably precious gift, that above all the peoples of the earth, God chose them to be his special people. Just as he says in Exodus chapter 19. In the middle of verse 3, he says, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob," instructing Moses, "and tell the people of Israel, you have seen, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my treasured possession among all the people, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel." But as the indictment of their sin continues, and then how in verse 10 it talks about how God found them in the middle of the desert, there are parallels between this and certain chapters of Ezekiel in which God describes finding Israel. And the picture that happens in Ezekiel is God finds Israel as a newborn baby who's cast on the side of the road that's drowning in its own blood and birth fluid with the umbilical cord wrapped around its neck, choking it. And if you can't picture that without being moved, you have no soul. And God takes that baby, like he takes these people in Deuteronomy 32. By the way, I don't literally mean you have no soul. You guys know what I mean. The heart is seared completely. He encircled them. He cared for them. He kept them as the apple of his eye. Verse 12, "The Lord alone guided him. He made him ride on the high places of the land, and he ate the produce of the field. He suckled him with honey out of the rock and out of the flinty rock, and oil out of the flinty rock." But in verse 15, we find again, "Jeshen grew fat," Kate, "grew fat, stout and sleek, that he forsook God who made him and scoffed at the rock of his salvation. They stirred him to jealousy with strange gods. With abominations they provoked him to anger. And they sacrificed to demons that were no gods, and to gods they had never known, to new gods that they had come recently, whom your fathers had never dreaded. You were unmindful of the rock that bore you, and you forgot the God who gave you birth." And as this condemnation continues, of course, there's this description that starts in verse 23 of God's wrath. That because they have forsaken him in such a horrible way, he says, "I will heap disasters upon them. I will spend my arrows on them, and they shall be wasted with hunger and devoured by plague, poisonous pestilence. And I will send the teeth of the beasts against them and the venom of things that crawl in the dust." Which is basically everything they had already experienced in the book of Numbers. And as the threat of punishment and as the promise of punishment continues, in verse 28, he says, "They're a nation void of counsel. There is no understanding in them. If they were wise, they would understand this, and they would discern their latter end. How could one have chased 1,000 and two have put 10,000 to flight, unless their rock had sold them and the Lord has given them up? For their rock is not as our rock. Our enemies are by themselves, for their vine comes from the vine of Sodom and from the fields of Gomorrah, and their grapes are grapes of poison, and their clusters are bitter. Their wine is the poison of serpents and the cruel venom of asps." How would you guys like to sing that song at every football game or baseball game? Because I'm going to tell you, it's not the most enthusiastic song around, you know, and it doesn't really fire you up to play a good game, it kind of does the opposite, right? You sort of get depressed, which is kind of the point behind this song. And when we get to verse 36, we find a promise. We find one thing in this song that gives Israel hope. What we find is we find the promise of forgiveness. That God can atone. For the Lord will vindicate His people and He will have compassion on His servants. And that when He sees that their power is gone, that there is none remaining, bond or free, then He will say, where are their gods, the rock in which they took refuge, who ate the fat of their sacrifices and drank the wine of their drink offering? Let them rise up and help you. Let them be your protector. But see now that I am, and there is no God beside me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal. And there is none that can deliver out of my hand. For I will lift up my hand to heaven and swear as I live forever. By the way, that's the origin. This song is the origin of the oath that David is famous for giving. As Yahweh lives. As Yahweh lives. He gets it from this song. And this song echoed down the generations, at the very least, until the time of David. And the prophets after him swore the same oath. As Yahweh lives. If I sharpen my flashing sword, my hand takes hold on judgment. I will take vengeance upon my adversaries and those, and I will repay those who hate me. I will make my arrows drunk with blood, and my sword shall devour flesh with the blood of the slain and the captives from the long-haired heads of the enemy. Rejoice with him, O heavens, and bow down to him, all gods, for he avenges the blood of his children and takes vengeance on his adversaries, and he repays those who hate them and cleanses his people's land. So it's not all miserable, right? Just most of it. And so at the end of this song, there's the promise that God can atone. God can deliver you. God can make things right even after you've forsaken Him. And that's the national anthem of the nation of Israel. But I want for us to think about this, right? These words, right? This song. Don't you guys think that describes a whole lot more than just Israel? Because I do. I mean, we look at it and we see its context in Deuteronomy, and we see Numbers, and we see the books that come after, and of course we see the connection. But when we get to taking this and pushing it forward and looking how did this song affect the nation of Israel throughout history, well, number one, we know David used an oath. He used words from this song to swear an oath to show that he meant what he said. And so we know that it endured at least then. But I want for us to go to the time in between Moses and Joshua and David. And that's the period of the judges. The period of the judges, like I said, like Numbers, is full of the worst stories in the Bible. As a matter of fact, Judges is probably tops Numbers for the worst stories in the Bible and the worst people in the Bible. And when you read the book of the Judges, what you find is you find the very words of this song come to life. Because the people, instead of, as Deuteronomy chapter 7 says, driving out the people of Canaan, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, and the other groups. The first one that we have recorded, at least, is Ephraim, that turns them into slaves. And as Deuteronomy 7 says, you don't intermarry with them, you don't mix yourselves with them, because if you do that, they're going to drag you away into idolatry. You're going to begin to offer sacrifices to false gods, right? That's Deuteronomy 7. And of course, what do? Well, they do the very thing that Moses says not to do. And what happens? The very thing that God, through this song, predicted would happen if they did that. And what we find in the book of Judges is this 350-year period of Israel forsaking God, of something forcing them to come to their senses. And when we ask ourselves the question, what in the world could have existed? Why were they motivated as this whole group of people? I mean, one of the things we have to keep in mind is, of course, is each judge is sort of localized, right? The nation never unites as a whole under this time period. The one judge who gets closest is Deborah, and she's the only woman out of the deliverers. But even then, Judah backs off and doesn't become a part of her alliance.
But we have 350 years of idolatry followed by pain and suffering. What could cause those who are being afflicted by this pain and suffering to, as one, turn again and repent? I don't know. But I'm guessing this song might have had something to do with it. Just guessing. Maybe. But this cycle repeats itself over and over and over again. How many of us have felt in our lives, honestly, like we were the people that Deuteronomy 32 describes? There were people who've broken our covenant with God and we've forsaken it and we've done something grossly wrong. Because I'm going to be honest, any of us who've been Christians for a sufficient amount of time have done that. Because this is what we struggle with as human beings. And you know, we seem to go through this cycle, don't we? Just like Israel in the time of the judges, we seem to go through this cycle. It looks like we finally kick this one thing that we're dealing with, this one sin that we're struggling with. And what happens? Something else rears its head and we get drawn away by that thing. And it consumes us and it takes over our life. And thus the cycle repeats itself over and over again. Just like you've got the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Edomites, the Philistines, the Arabians, and the Syrians to the north, the Phoenicians. This is life. I want us to go to further into chapter 32. Begin reading in verse 46. The question for us is, how do we break that cycle? How do we take our lives and decide to be better? How do we do something about this continued cycle over and over and over again that we can never seem to escape? Because after all, even Paul in Romans 7 talks about this, right? The very evil that I abhor, I find myself doing anyway. The thing that I want to do, the ability to do it seems to escape me. I can't manage to do it. He said to them, verse 46, "Take heart all the words by which I am warning you today, that you may command them to your children, that they may be careful to do all the words of this law. For it is no empty word for you, but your very life. And by this word, you shall live long in the land that you are going to possess, or going over the Jordan to possess." This is our life, right? You know, there's two ways that could be taken, aren't there? That could be taken as this song describes our life. And it does, doesn't it? It describes the struggle that we have with sin. This one thing gets a hold of me. I seem like I've got a handle on that. I've gotten that out of my life. This other thing comes up, rears its head like we said before. But it's also this song, and understanding this song is the source of your life. And that's true not just for Israel, but for us. On Sunday nights, we're talking about the law of Moses and its relationship to the Christian. This is as clear as it gets. This song, understanding this song, is the source of my life. It's the source of your life. That my sin mires me and draws me away from God. God has the power to atone. And when we project this forward, like I said, we go forward, we wind the clock forward, we look at the years, the decades, the centuries that go by after this. And Israel seems like it's in this never-ending cycle over and over and over again of sin and idolatry and oppression. Sin here, sin there, oppression here, oppression there. And no one can ever seem to break free. Until one day, the people wake up and they realize they need a change. And that change happens in 1 Samuel 8. And that change happens when the people realize what they really need is something new. Because the same patterns and the same lifestyle don't work. What they need, they understood, was a king. They needed a king to guide them and to lead them. And they were absolutely right about that. They needed a king. But the problem, of course, in 1 Samuel 8 is not that they're asking for a king, because that's exactly what they need. And God had spoken of a king, both in Leviticus and in Deuteronomy, about your kings, your leaders, your rulers, your king, specifically mentioned in Deuteronomy 17. They needed their king to break them free. But the thing that escaped their notice at the time of Samuel, at the end of Samuel's life, by the way, that was another Samuel's you're old and about to die moment. The thing that escaped their notice was they didn't need a man to be their king. They needed God to be their king. And that's why Saul failed, because he didn't understand that. It was a truth that Gideon understood in the days of the judges. It was a truth that others understood. It was a truth that David himself understood. That David, the one who was anointed by Samuel the prophet, the one who was crowned as king, the one who sat on the throne in Jerusalem, the fortress, the citadel of peace, sits there and talks about the Lord, my king. He understood that. That's why God called him a man after my own heart. And I'm here to tell you the same thing about Israel is true for us. If we want to break free from this cycle, we need our king. Because he can smash the chains of sin that weigh us down. And the thing about this is that, you know, we're never going to be able to truly get rid of sin in our lives, but he can show us a way to make our life better. And he can take the pain and the suffering, the guilt and the burden of guilt away and say, you don't have to worry about it anymore. Our king can break this cycle. Rejoice with him, O heaven, and bow down to him. If you're here tonight and your life is caught in this cycle that perpetuates itself, whether it's a cycle of sin or any other kind of problem that you have, anything you're struggling with, whatever it is, your king can break the cycle for you. Here's where I want to launch off into Isaiah 59, but I won't, because we're out of time. But if you're here tonight and you want to come to your king and crown him as the king of your heart and the king of your life, then this word too for you can be life. If you're here, there's any prayer at all we can offer on your behalf, any way we can serve you, if it's by comfort or encouragement, or if it's by helping you give your oath of allegiance to your king by going under the waters of baptism. Whatever it is, please come forward and let us know what it is as we stand and sing song number 326.